Good evening, everyone. I hope everyone is well and healthy. And if you are ill and struggling, may you find health and ease as soon as possible. And having patience for that. All right, tonight we're going to move into the next cycle of dependent origination on contact. But I just want to acknowledge this past week and how difficult it has been, how much has pain has come up. It reminds us that what we struggle with this COVID illness, there's this other illness which has been here all along. It's been here for generations upon generations, causing as much illness and death and poverty as COVID is. And of course, I'm talking about racism. You know, this really, it's an illness of the mind, of the heart. And in this way, it becomes really within the realm of Dharma practice. It's alluring to how to see our own hidden racism, our own unconsciousness, our own sense of otherness. And as much as people who are the objects of racism as the ones who are racist, we all have a responsibility to fully look at this, to fully embrace this. And it becomes a beautiful avenue, maybe not a beautiful avenue, but a powerful avenue for practice, for Dharma exploration, particularly around this topic of dependent origination. Because we can see how dependent origination also shows us the seeds of racism, of that sense of otherness, of sense of prejudice, of discrimination. It shows that is very, very clearly. Because racism, the act of acting racist or even having those beliefs, is just a manifestation of selfing, a manifestation of suffering. And it has its own causes and conditions, as we've been exploring so far this year. And looking at it in this way, it takes dependent origination out of the abstract, out of something which is theoretical, into the very fabric of our minds, of our hearts, into the unconsciousness that we don't realize is there, that shapes our bias toward how we see others in the world, how we see ourselves in the world. So this month, we're going to be exploring contact, the next cycle. And tonight I will particularly weave in this exploration of how this contact exploration can help us with understanding racism, particularly in our own hearts, our own minds, how this one link can hold the seed to our suffering, the suffering of everything, of all forms of suffering, and the suffering of racism. So what is contact? What is contact? So all the six senses, including the mind, including thought, it has to, three things have to come together for contact to occur, right? So we have to have, let's look at sound, for example. We have to have an ear that works. We have to have a sound that arises. And we have to be paying attention. We have to have consciousness, ear consciousness, to be able to have contact arise. So as I ring this bell, if I have this working ear, if I can have something to hear like the bell, and I have the awareness or the consciousness of the ear, you can hear the sound. But let's say I muted myself. I rung that bell just as loudly, but that part was interrupted. So there wasn't the contact of the sound. There wasn't the contact of knowing that sound is there. So if we're absorbed in a different field of consciousness, like we're lost in a daydream or really absorbed in some visual stimulus, we may not pick up on a sound, on particularly a subtle sound. But when all three are present, the working sense gate, the sense of consciousness around that sense gate, and the actual object, then we have contact. We have that moment of touching, of awareness, of touching, of life touching us. So contact really brings us up into this very present moment, into what is actually happening right here, right now, in this instant, in this very moment, this micro moment. If we tuned in, if our attention was steady and sustained, you could see the contacts were constantly arising. Even now as you sit, there's the sound of my voice. There's the sensation of the air touching your skin. There's the sensations of your body, the sounds in your room, in your home. All these are moments of contact, constantly washing over us. And of course, we can't attend to all of them. We can only, one comes to the forefront and then another one. And it's easier to see this contact arising when we ourselves are quiet, when we have a sense of stillness, a sense of attentiveness. And from this backdrop of stillness, of quiet, and of receptivity, then something, we can see it arising. Something emerges. Perhaps when you've been meditating on a retreat or meditating at home, and the conditions are such that there's a steadiness, this receptivity, this inner stillness, that a sound may emerge, but not the reaction to that sound. Maybe not even the label of that sound. Just the direct, immediate experience of that sound. And in the arising of it, we clearly see how transitory it is, how it's just something that's arising and will also fade. And from this place of stillness, of quiet, of meditative awareness, we can see it much more clearly, the sensations in the body arising and passing. And we can also experience this in our lives if we're able to sit quietly, perhaps in nature, with nothing to do, without daydreaming or planning or worrying, just enjoying the play of the sun on the trees. And you see a bird fly across. That's a moment of contact, and it flies away. Now, contact is just that very moment of sense data, raw sense information being known. It's not what comes immediately after. It's not our reactivity, our wanting it, not wanting it, our longing, even the sense of pleasant and unpleasant, is a next step. This is what we'll explore later in this year as Tuari and I continue to unfold this dependent origination. Those move us along the cycle of dependent origination, the cycle of suffering. And this is a really important practice point. I think each of these links offer these places of practice that we can really engage in and dig into. And this practice point is to come back to that bare attention, to borrow Joseph Goldstein's phrase, that bare attention, the actual sense input, not our interpretation of it, not our ideas of what that contact is, or our reaction to that contact. So often we confuse this constantly, that something arises and we confuse our interpretation for that actual thing. We confuse what our ideas are of it from what it actually is. And this is such a source of conflict when we argue, my experience is different than yours. And we're really arguing not the sound or the sight or the smell or the thought, but we're arguing about our interpretation of that. We also mistake our reactivity to that sense data as being the actual core thing, the actual bare data of sound, of sensation. And this confusion is what creates beliefs, dogma, prejudice, racism. It creates a sense of self, the sense of other, in a very profound, in a very concrete way. Concrete in that we act from it. We make our lives revolve around that. Even though if you look, we see it is no different than a passing cloud. So we'll come back to how to practice with contact at the end of this evening, because I think it's really important to have a strong sense of how to do this. Now, we tend to think of contact, of this sense data, again, any sense data, sight, smell, taste, touch, hearing, Start to repeat the one's thought. As those arise, we tend to think of them as being neutral. It's like it's kind of objective. Like if we were a scientist, we would all agree upon the raw data. You know, this is, you know, scientist A, scientist B will say, yeah, that's the sound. It's this amount. It's objective, unbiased, shared by everyone. We assume that we all see and hear and experience the same thing. But even looking a little bit, we see this is not true. And this is very, very curious thing. You know, certainly our reaction to the same sense data, we can see that. But we think that's what where it is. But it's actually the very way it's perceived, the very moment of contact is conditioned. It's unique to each person's history, each person's upbringing, cultural influences, societal influences, your experiences, both good and traumatic. I often like to point to this example of this bridge in France, that the same exact bridge, when it was built, the Germans looked at it and described it as being graceful and elegant, while the French looked at it and said, wow, it's powerful and massive and strong. Such a different experience, such a different interpretation of the exact same sense input. So curious, why is this? It's because the sense data isn't neutral. It's actually shaped. It's actually shaped by our minds very profoundly. We rarely have just the contact. We can train this as practitioners of meditation to learn to come back to that bare attention. This is so much of our practice, the bedrock of our practice is learning to connect with that. Sometimes we're in the midst of an experience that we've never had before, seeing a newborn child, and you're just full of wonder, seeing something that's so beautiful, coming into the mystery of someone passing, of death. All these can be moments of our normal way of interpreting life falls away, and there's just the direct knowing, the direct experience. But usually, so often, we experience things through our history. Really, instead of seeing life directly, we're actually seeing a reflection of our own mind. We're seeing a reflection of our own mind, our own conditioning, the label, the perception, the reaction, all the past conditioning, the training, the experiences, all the past reactivity, the cravings, the aversions, all those come together to shape this moment of contact. So instead of being neutral and universal, it's very individual and shaped. So that bridge in France, one of the deepest conditionings we have is language. This is the way we interpret the world. And in France, they look at the word for bridge is masculine. So naturally, they attribute that unconsciously to how they see it. They shape that very interpretation, that raw data of seeing this bridge as being masculine. While in German, it's feminine. And there's a different shaping. And they may argue about what kind of bridge it is over this basic shift of shaping, of conditioning. So what's added on, what's conditioned to this moment? And this moment can be shaped. It can be conditioned by ignorance, by our delusion, by our confusion, by how we've dealt with the suffering of our lives and how that's been shaped into more ignorance and causing more suffering. This is what the whole dependent origination teaching is about, that this backdrop of ignorance shapes the very way we perceive this moment. It gives us that kind of preloads the way we tend to see this moment. And then our reactivity comes from that. And then we perpetuate, we create this another cycle of suffering, of selfing, of creating this sense of I, of me. But also it can be shaped by wisdom. It can be shaped by understanding through practice, learning how to bring our deepest understanding to this moment, to see life very clearly. Both the Buddha and Jesus talked about clearing the dust from one's eyes. Clearing the dust from one's eyes so we can see clearly, see directly. And that moment of suffering often leads, that moment of contact often leads to suffering. Sometimes very obvious ways that someone says something that triggers me, that hooks me. I feel a moment of racism, of prejudice, and the contraction, the suffering is so obvious. And sometimes it's much less obvious ways we form that sense of self, of an isolated self experiencing this. Now, one of the profound ways that modern research has looked at this issue of how we condition the moment's experience is around implicit bias. How we look at something and our unconsciousness shapes the way we see it, especially around racial bias. That is this unconscious programming that we see another person, another something we consider other, and there's a background way that we're biased against them. It could be used often against them in terms of a sense of prejudice, of distrust, of anger. This is a modern way of describing the cycle of dependent origination, and particularly the previous links, the one of sankharas, of consciousness, of name and form, and of the sense doors. This is representing this implicit bias and how that shapes and prejudices us to how we perceive life. It actually profoundly distorts how we perceive life. And from that distortion, our actions are distorted. Our actions are based in fear, in anger, in delusion. So if I see someone that I label as a different race, for example, someone that is other than me, what arises with that from that implicit bias? Perhaps a sense of distrust, of fear, of hatred even. It's not based on that person. It's not based on who that person actually is, but on my mind. I'm seeing a reflection of my mind, of my ignorance, of my unconscious. It's not based in reality at all. It's not based on the raw sense data of who that person actually is, but on my conditioning from what my parents taught me, what their parents taught, my schools, my society, my culture, my experiences, my actions, all ways of describing the power of sankharas, the power of name and form. And then from that bias, my reactivity flows. The contact of sight, and then from there I get reactive. And if I'm a place of authority, a place of power, the actions can be devastating. If I have a gun, I may be more likely to make a bad decision, a fatal decision. So the Buddha described this, that from contact, the whole world arises. The whole world arises. And when we're gripped by this unconscious power of dependent origination, of this implicit bias, from this point of contact, we create this whole world around that. This whole world of my fear, my anger, my hatred, my whole sense of otherness. And from there, the actions flow. So it makes something as complex and painful as racism, it makes it much more clear, but also at the same time, it can be very sobering how deep this goes, how profoundly unconscious it is, and how hard it is to pierce through that, how hard it is to clear that dust from our eyes. So I see something, I hear something, then I move into the process of reactivity that grows into the shaping of my world. And my reactivity becomes my world de facto. Not in truth, but the actual way I perceive the world becomes a sort of reality. And this is within all of us, every being, every person. It may not be of race, it may be of gender, of age, of sexual orientation, of class, of education, of intelligence, of body size. However, we create that sense of otherness, of a different culture, a different way of being in the world. This is the formation of the selfing. This is what self feels like. And this is the mechanism, just with the moment of contact. We walk all day without having a moment of contact. And when that arises, this whole world arises with it. Now, the good news is, as meditators, we have one of the best tools for seeing through this. We have one of the most profound and powerful tools, that of mindfulness and investigation, that allows us to see through this unconscious power of our bias, the unconscious momentum of our sankharas, of our name and form, to actually see life directly and fully, to see it actually how it is, and to see the reactivity that arises with us, and learn that we don't have to act from that. We can actually meet that too with the space of mindfulness, of compassion. And that way we start to clear this out so we can see what is really a true action, what's a true contact, and what's a true skillful action that can come from that. So I want to offer three ways to practice with it, or three aspects of really, if you look closely, they're all one and the same. And I'm framing this in terms of working with it in a meditative state. Not because we can't bring it into the nitty-gritty of our lives, into the difficult situations, but because it's unconscious, we need a quality of often stability to see more deeply. Sometimes the urgency can bring that clarity. It's learning to access it in the simple ways, in the easy ways, but realizing that this simple way of meeting life translates directly into the much more charged, the much, much more complex issues of our day and of our life. And the way that I'm going to explore this, it's the goal isn't to act, but to learn to see clearly. So often we go into, how do I act? But I come back again and again to see clearly first, and then the actions arise from that. From that clarity, wise action arises. This is what's taught in the Eightfold Path. The clarity of sight leads to wisdom, and from wisdom leads to wise action. This beautiful interplay between clear seeing, wisdom, and action. So again, this is good to practice with easy things at first till you get the handle of it and start to see through the momentum of your bias, of your implicit bias. And essentially, what we're trying to do is rest with the pure contact, to keep coming back and orienting ourselves to that direct sense data, whichever sense that might be there. And releasing everything that we add to it, releasing our conditioning, our prejudice, our assumption of what it is, even the label, it's helpful to release and relax. And relaxing our reactivity to it, our sense of it's something that we need to do with it, something that we want to get rid of, we want more of. To simply be with, that there's just this. There's just this. And really, these three aspects are words. The first one is sensitivity. It's sensitivity. So opening the sense gates with a quality of care and a quality of patience. Like with sounds, a lovely way to practice this, that often we notice the most obvious sounds in the room. And notice how there's this quiet sounds, the distant, subtle, the whispers, the subtle, unseen, overlooked sounds. That's what I mean by opening the sense gates, learning to see, hear, sense, taste in a much deeper way, a much more profound way. And as in the homework I mentioned, it's very helpful I think, to emphasize a few of the senses over other ones. The reason I say this is that some of the senses have more discrete things that arise. They're kind of a moment of arising and they tend to fall away. So sound's a nice example of that. You know, unless it's like a monotone, it's going to tend to have this fluctuation. You hear a car horn, you hear a siren, you hear a bird chirp. These arise and they fall away. And so you can sit with this background stillness that's able to receive that. Smell can be like this also, that you're from the place of stillness, you can smell a flower or smell cooking, that moment of contact. Learning to have that deeper sensitivity to it, that deeper quality of receptivity. Sensation can be like that also, unless it's something that's a chronic, ongoing sensation. Something like the breath even rises and falls, or an itch, or a warmth or pressure here and there. Taste also can be very helpful. Sight is a little harder because it's constantly coming at us. It's like this constant onslaught. It's harder to see the arising and passing. But it's very true that we can rest in the contact, simply the contact in the same way. And thought, of course, has its own issues. It also can be just ongoing and also has this tendency to take us into it, to allow us to, we tend to get swept away with thought and lose the sense of perspective, that sense of I am watching, I am knowing this experience. So particularly focusing on sensation, on smell, on sound, on taste, that they can be very helpful to practice in this way. So learning to see the nuances, to sense the nuances. This can actually be very delightful, can be very interesting, it can be very engaging, to bring that quality of sensitivity. Because we can only be sensitive if we relax. If we relax our bodies, if we relax our minds and our hearts, if we're not defended. To allow subtle things to be fully known, to be fully received. So sensitivity. The next one is non-resistance. Non-resistance to what is that moment of contact. So certainly as we will explore next month, each contact point has a quality of being pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, a vedana, of the feeling tone, as we often talk about. And we're kind of pre-programmed. We have this impulse to do something with the pleasant and unpleasant. We pull the unpleasant, push the unpleasant away from us, pull the pleasant toward us, and ignore the unpleasant, the neutral. So this non-resistance brings us back into that moment of sense, direct sense knowing, that direct sensing, that direct contact. So of course the vedana will arise, that sense of pleasant and unpleasant, perhaps the sense of clinging and craving and wanting, not wanting will arise. So this is this practice of non-reactivity. Can I learn to meet this moment experience with as little resistance as possible? So this can mean relaxing the need to do something with, to fix it, to become better at, less than at, get rid of this in me, get more of this in me. It can even be the sense of evaluating, of kind of pondering and thinking. And this is a moment by moment practice. So we're not talking about life, bigger life choices, or even choices through the day or decisions. Learning how to come right into this moment and meet it in a particular way of sensitivity, of non-resistance. Now, thought is a big part, a big area of our resistance to in an experience. And so as much of our practice is learning to relate to thought in a different way, not to be governed by thought, not to be slaves to our thought, but learning how to let thought be a tool that we pick up, but not being thought be what drives our lives from birth to death, from morning to night. But learning to see thought, okay, that's just another experience. As I think Twery talked about last month, holding thought as equal to other sense data, as you would hold a sensation in the body, as you would hold a sound. So learning to come back into this direct moment's experience of smell, of taste, of touch, of sound, of hearing, without resistance. A funny thing about working with non-resistance is often that creates a deeper resistance to arise. I say, okay, I'm not going to resist this moment's experience. And yet our resistance starts to bubble up. This is the aspect or manifestation of the hindrances. And we'll talk a little bit later in a few minutes. We'll talk about what to do when experience is too much. It's as a strong point of contact, how to work with that, or if it's charged with trauma. But for right now, working with the easy, the sensitivity, the non-resistance, and the final aspect, the final triad of this is the non-self aspect. So not to make this too abstract or too inaccessible, but simply when you experience and we have a sense data like a sound, trying to soften kind of the interpreter, the sense of the middleman that goes from the sense data to the consumer, to actually let that distance, that sense of separation start to soften. So there's simply the sense of knowing itself without having to be interpreted as me meditating, as me sensing, hearing, tasting. And it can feel like that distance just softens or shrinks or fades. There's a sense of softening, a sense of dissolving, that sense of me having to be in control. So very tied with non-resistance, very tied to sensitivity. And if you're able to do this, if you're able to get a taste of this, you'll find that by doing so, there's a deeper stillness that arises. There's a deeper quality of ease, of presence that meets you in that. And of course, we start to relax the habitual need to always be there, to always be the person who is knowing, who is doing. There can be a bit of dis-ease, a sense of disorientation. Like, who is watching if I'm not watching? Who is sensing? If I'm not tracking this, if I'm not trying to figure out what to do, is this whole thing going to fall apart? So when that arises, coming back to that non-resistance, letting that also flow through you. The sensitivity, opening deeper to the sense gates to provide that grounding, that orientation, that there is something that is knowing. There is something that is receiving this sense data, even though it may not seem like it's you. Maybe something much bigger, much larger than the normal contracted sense of you. So these three aspects of sensitivity, of non-resistance, and non-self can help us orient back to that bare sense data, that bare moment of contact. As we do so, then all the reactivity may arise, all the conditioning arises, but we're able to start to release it. We're able to start to decondition it from us. So we become deeper tastes to that what is unconditioned, what is beyond that sense of selfing, beyond suffering. Now, this process can be very helpful to work with thought. Usually when thoughts arise, we engage with it. We want to add more thoughts to it. Whether it's a positive thought or a thought we find engaging, like, oh, that's interesting. Or the cycle of worry and obsession that just seems to spiral us into this like a moth to the flame, more and more stress, more and more worry. Or if we're a meditator, we fight with the fact that we're thinking. Darn it, I'm not supposed to be thinking. I'm supposed to be paying attention to my breath. So thought also is a moment of contact. It's also a sense gate. So if we can learn to work with it in this way, to do this, we have to relax the content, or at least relax our obsession with the content, to connect with the actual experience of thought arising. To do this, I think it's very helpful to shift to the other senses in the body, particularly the body, and sight and sound, to see how when a thought arises, there's also echoes in this whole mind-body. In this way, we're able to maintain that point of contact, maintaining that point of steadiness on this moment of contact, learning to relax and discharge this tendency into proliferation, into thought, into selfing. Now, this, again, the way I described this was a way to practice when the moment is fairly easy to meet. It's easy to receive. A bird song, you know, the sense of a gentle sensation going through the body. But often in our lives, we have times when it's not so gentle, when it's not so easy to meet, whether it's our body racked with pain, or if it's the fear of hearing a flash bomb go off in downtown Seattle, or if it's the fear of having someone attack you with their racism. So all these moments of contact, we have to, the same technique we talked about can bring forth that, and it's helpful to modify that a little bit. So reactivity, when it's kind of a moderate reactivity, we can track the waves of reactivity move through our system. It's like if I threw a big stone into the river or to the lake, it would make a big splash and many ripples. And you just track how those ripples move through. You track the sub ripples of the splash. So if something is, a moment of contact is so triggering though, that it starts to maybe elicit trauma response. And then it's really helpful to notice that, to know that, okay, this moment of contact is really amping up my nervous system. It's amping up my heart rate and my adrenaline system. My endocrine system is all mobilizing with this fight and flight and freeze response. It's helpful to shift your attention to another moment of contact, another field of awareness. What I mean by this is we talked about this a bit in the month I did on consciousness, is at any moment, there's multiple things we can focus on. We can intentionally shift our attention to something that isn't so charged. Now, this is something we struggle with as meditators because we feel like we need to stay in there and work on the hard stuff. But if our minds become brittle, if we become contracted, it can be counterproductive. It can even be damaging to our practice if we really push. But learning to find, okay, what in this moment isn't cooler, is neutral, is easy to meet. And learning to come back to the same process of meeting it, allowing that sensitivity, that quality of non-resistance, of non-selfing. Then our attention starts to relax with that contact. And then we can go back and forth to that charged area in the body and outside and emotion and meet that for a few moments. And we start to find ourselves having a greater and greater capacity. If we're very gentle with ourselves, if we're titrating, adding a little bit at a time until that sense of balance arises. So this process of meaning experience, to make this a little bit more concrete, noticing something that we have, let's going back to that racial bias or that implicit bias, that noticing some aspect that you may hold, that when you feel or see a picture or experience someone who represents that bias, you may not even know this, you may not even realize that you have that. They may feel that echoes in the body, the uncomfortableness, the sense of dis-ease. ripples in the body sensations, or maybe movements of your unedited thoughts. And turn toward that contact, whether it's a picture or the experience of another person, with curiosity. With curiosity, then we've turned toward it with a sense of interest, with sensitivity. What is here? Without assumptions. You know, what is in this mind? What is in this heart? What is the echoes that are arising in the body, the echoes in the mind? By doing so, you're bringing the unconscious to the conscious level of knowing, of seeing, having non-resistance to that very experience. It may be painful. You may be ashamed to sense that. You may be shocked to see that. It may be very different than who you take yourself to be. The non-resistance, the willingness to be able to let this too be seen, this too be known. And then being willing to relax the selfing around it, the non-self aspect. Okay, I don't have to make a new story about what this means about me. Letting that sense of knowing become very close. You don't have to interject the sense of me into that. There's the simple knowing. Allowing the sense of what knows to become quieter and at the same time much broader, much larger than that narrow sense of self. And when you do this, you may find that you're relating to this person with a more direct contact. The waves of conditioning may arise and pass through, waves of reactivity, but in a very critical way, both that reactivity and the conditioning are the same thing. The past and present reactivity has the same root of ignorance. And being willing to work with this in this way, we start to profoundly shift the seeds of racism that we may hold in our own hearts, in our own minds. And in this way, when we act, go out into the world to act, it's coming from a place of wisdom. It's coming from a place of clarity and power. And that's what we need in this time. We've been needing it for hundreds and hundreds of years. But perhaps we're finally having enough momentum to fully transfer, more deeply transform this illness of racism. And I hope you see that dependent origination is not an abstract teaching. It's a very immediate, practical, and profound teaching to show us how our very lives, our very sense of selfing arises, our sense of suffering arises moment after moment. All right, if we could just sit quietly for a few moments and letting those words settle. I'd like to just say a few words about the practice and reflection for this week, and we'll use this as the basis for our discussion next week. So again, when you're practicing, when you're quiet and attentive, whether it's on the cushion or it's a time when you're just in nature or just at home with the mind is naturally relaxed and receptive, practice with noticing the actual moment of sense contact, sound, sensation, and smell and taste, maybe the easiest, the most accessible, to see the rising and the passing away. Try to relax and release the tendency to label and to react. Just rest with the direct knowing. Just rest with the direct experience. So practice with the quality of sensitivity, with non-resistance, and with non-self. And as you do this, notice how your relationship to the moment's experience may shift. There may be a deeper accessibility and availability. There may be a sense of ease that arises, a sense of peace. All right, so thank you for your attention. And now we have a chance for any questions that you may have. I'm going to give you permission to unmute yourselves. And then if you have a question, you can unmute yourself and ask it, or you can also send a chat. Let's see if I can figure this out. Okay, I think now you can unmute yourself. Yes.
Hey, Tim.
Hi.
It's Peter.
Hi, Peter.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you for your teaching tonight, and I really appreciate how you link this to the current issues erupting in our society. The one thing that occurred to me is, you know, this certainly is a good example of something that we can apply from the Buddhist teaching to this, to racism. One other thing that I found very helpful was a book that Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote about the, I'll get the exact title and put it in the chat, but he basically extracted teachings from the Pali texts about social organization that he wrote, he collected into this book in response to a lot of the things that were happening in Myanmar around the Rohingya, where there was a lot of kind of racism and prejudice against this ethnic group by Buddhists. Yes. Toward Muslims, as a way of showing that isn't really consistent with the Buddha's teaching. It's coming out as a cultural reaction, and it was very helpful to me. I read it on the way to Myanmar. So, it was a wonderful. I guess, illustration of the Buddha's awareness of racism and hatred in society that gets institutionalized and what ways to kind of work to prevent that.
Yes, yeah, lovely. Thank you for sharing that, Peter. And I think I recall Bhikkhu Bodhi created that document, that list of suttas that focused on the issues of racism in response to the kind of the justification of some of the Buddhist in those countries.
Yes.
Saying that, and to confront that.
And yes, exactly.
You know, we really owe a debt of gratitude to Bhikkhu Bodhi and others for knowing the suttas so deeply and to understand when something is being distorted like that.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
I have a question, Tim.
Yes. Hi, Lauren.
Yes. Consciousness, like sense consciousness, like ear consciousness and nose consciousness and, you know, those different consciousnesses. And contact, what's the difference between them?
Between the different, say that one more time.
Well, contact, I'm trying to figure out how all these links go together. And so contact's a moment where we're attending to a particular sense object through a sense door.
Yes.
Is that correct? So
how does that all relate to the rest of the links?
Yeah, the consciousness, specifically the difference between what's going on with the sense door consciousness, like ear consciousness, and then there's contact. So contact's the moment where the three come together and the consciousness. Yeah, what is the consciousness then with those three things?
Yes. So it's one of the things which is for contact to occur, as you mentioned, it's really dependent upon having a gate of that's working. Like the hearing has to be present. You have to have working ears. You also have to be paying attention.
right,
to sound itself. That's the quality of consciousness.
Okay.
Okay, so ear consciousness is just being tuned into sound.
I see.
Eye consciousness is being tuned into, you know, this. You know, how many times have you eaten something and not really tasted it?
Right.
You know, you're eating it, obviously, but you're thinking about something else or having a conversation or watching TV. Your consciousness is kind of shut down or turned down in that. So it's not really the moment of contact. And so that's why we need the sense of our attention landing in that sense, you know, gates consciousness, right? So it's kind of, it feels a little bulky and a little kind of hard to see because it happens so quickly. It's like we can shift very seamlessly from one to other.
Yeah.
And we kind of connect the dots. We create this whole picture of continuity. But really our attention, our consciousness has shifted from ear consciousness to eye consciousness to hearing consciousness. And then when those moments come together and there's something to actually hear, then we have contact.
And then the stiller we are, the more able we are to experience the bare attention.
Yes, because the stiller we are, we're not being, what happens when we're stiller is where the reactivity is quieted down. Okay, the sense of impulse to do something with. This is really the rest of the year in dependent origination, is looking at craving and clinging and becoming and birth. These are all more harder, more forms of reactivity, of being invested, of being wanted. And so if we're not really paying attention to that, we're just kind of cycling through that all the time. But for quiet, that moment of contact can arise and kind of just being float there by itself. You know, we've trained ourselves to maybe not move into that sense of reactivity, of craving, of aversion. So it just simply known.
So it seems like there would be, to get that stillness, there would be lots of letting go, like something would arise that would be in a reactive mode and you'd let it go. And then something else would, because it's very hard to just have bare attention, you know?
Well, so the sense of bare attention, often it does take a lot of work to arrive there, that we have to release a lot. We have to release our reactivity, keep coming back. We have to release our daydreams. And yet the practice, I think this is something we may miss, is that we think we have to always be working so hard at it. Okay, there's also this way that when the practice really works, when it really has a transformational thing, there's a naturalness that arises.
Mm-hmm.
That it feels like it's too much to try to do something other than simply receive it.
Oh, yes. I see what you're saying.
That can arise in the middle of a retreat or a practice period. Yeah. But also as we practice and as our wisdom starts to come more to the forefront, that becomes more naturally available.
Yeah.
Becomes more of our natural default.
Yeah, because one of the things that always happens, like with sound, is, you know, I want to just hear the sound, but I put the label just gets in there really fast.
Yeah.
And then I get frustrated, you know, and I think, no, I just want to hear the pure sound and not be categorizing it. But it, like you said, there must be a different route to get there than just trying to keep that label from arising because it's too natural.
Yes. And actually trying to keep the label from arising is going against the direction. It's actually creating a level of, you had a hindrance, you know, reactivity you've added.
Yeah.
You've made, basically, you know, like you're trying to untie a knot and you've just pulled the whole thing tighter.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, when the label comes up, say, oh, the label's here.
Yeah.
If you can have no resistance to the label, that's actually the quickest way for the label not to arise.
Yeah. Okay.
But when there was a resistance, like, oh no, I'm having that label again. You know, I've kind of added more fuel to this whole process.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Tim.
You're welcome. Yeah, it's such an interesting interplay between effort and non-effort. But the trajectory of our practice should go more and more toward the non-effort. So if we're really struggling with this moment's experience, it's helpful to either check in with the teacher or to just step back and say, okay, what is this really about struggling? Remember, Rodney often would say that the end is the means. And if we want that sense of deep peace and the deep ease, that's the means we use in the, all the way along the path. We can't hate ourselves into love. And we can't struggle ourselves into peace. All right, thank you, Lauren. Anyone else would like to share anything? And if you're having trouble unmuting yourself, you could send a quick chat, if that makes sense. Or you could raise your hand.
Tim, I was just wondering if you could tell me again the three parts to contact. It resonates with me because there are three networks, three levels of the nervous system. A peripheral, a second, and then the storytelling network. And I was wondering how those correspond.
Now, when you say the three aspects of, you mean the three things that have to come together for contact to occur?
Yes.
Yes. So there has to be a working sense gate, right? So you have to have an ear that works, or an eye that works, or a tongue that works. You have to have the quality of consciousness. You have to be tuned into that field of knowing, and you have to have something to be aware of, right? So if there's no sound, contact won't happen. If our ears are damaged or we're deaf, we won't be able to have contact. Or if we're just checked out, paying attention to a different sense gate, we won't have contact either. Is that what you're asking for?
I think so. It's just our, you know, in our understanding of the nervous system, there are sensory endings that are always responding.
Yes.
And they're always making contact with the central nervous system at the spinal reflex level.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if that's the reactivity.
Well, in terms of a neurology standpoint, I'm just going to see what emerges with that question, right, as I haven't thought that through in the same way. But I think generally Buddhist teaching is focusing on the kind of the higher level nervous system, you know, the sense of when it goes into the central nervous system, and particularly the brain, you know, the spinal reflexes, that if it's kind of going underneath the sense of consciousness, of it's kind of subconscious or kind of running at that segmental level, it's not triggering dependent origination in the same way. It's not triggering the sense of selfing.
If I may, we always think they're happening simultaneously. And the third level is the cortical storytelling. This is the word. This is what's happening. That's the third network that's just saying what's happening. And it can either be paying attention to the actual reactivity, or it's just telling the story, whether from memory or from creative imagination or history of experience. But isn't that the internal sense that the Buddha's talked about, that it's one of the sense gates?
Oh, yes. The sixth sense of the mind. Yes. Yeah. Yes, yeah, that the mind's, yeah, the sense of storytelling, the sense of narrative, the sense of making meaning of, that's all, it's just the way he framed it is really that's a sense gate, just like, you know, touch, or just like sound, or just like, you know, smelling.
And that this is just happening all the time, all three, simultaneously.
Yes.
And that's how the behavioral biasing occurs, of what senses to pay attention to. It filters the second level, the spinal cord level.
And so then if the Buddha's teaching is correct, which obviously I think it is. There is the potential for changing that.
Yes.
Changing where the bias is and really purifying it or changing it so it's not unconscious. There's not a quality of driven by our reactivity, by our fear, our greed, or hatred, but really driven by a different quality of compassion and wisdom.
And that's what I'm grateful for, and that's what neuroscience tells us is true about the nervous system, the neuroplastic sense of it. So thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Yeah, it sounds like a good exploration. I think the Buddha would really appreciate, if he was alive in this time, what science is teaching us is discovering. And I think he was well above, beyond his time, how much he was able to perceive just through the clarity of mind, the clarity of seeing. All right, anyone else like to share anything? All right, so we'll shift into some announcements, and Khaled will be doing those. And before he starts, I want to just share a few things about a diversity training that we're working with on some of the leadership level and the board and the local Dharma leaders, but also with opening it up to the Sangha. So this is through a teacher named Ruth King, and she wrote a book called Mindfulness of Race. And so the particular approach to this is a year-long program. It's really run through her organization. So we're just trying to form some small groups to go through that process. And I'm helping to try to coordinate that by helping groups form. So if you're interested, I think there'll be an email going out from our SIMS mailing list shortly that has more information, or you can contact me directly. She's a wonderful teacher, wonderful approach. And it's really about learning to understand our own racial identity and how that creates that sense of bias toward other races, and how we can use that as a platform to start to do some of this healing work. So if you have any questions, you're welcome to email me or look for that email from the SIMS newsletter. And I'll send also out a new copy of the practice and reflection. So it kind of gets blurred together, but hopefully you can copy and paste it. And it'll be posted on the website. Okay, Khaled, do you would like to take it over?
Sure, sounds good. Hi, everyone, I'm Khaled. This is Valerie. I'm just doing the announcements tonight. I'm on the board. So the few events coming up in the next month or so. So we have the Nine Bodies retreat with Tuareg on Friday, June 12th from 7 to 9, and Saturday and Sunday from 9 to 4:30. These are all online. There's a Buddha's Essentials class on the three characteristics starting on Wednesday, June 17th, and that'll be monthly for the rest of the year. There's an intro class with Tim starting on Thursday, July 9th, Thursday evening, 7 to 9 p.m. And our Climate Action Group is hosting a four-hour event on July 11th. That's a Saturday from 10 to 2 p.m. It's called Reflecting on the Climate Crisis, Despair, Guilt, Love, and Connection, Opening to the Full Catastrophe. There'll be presentations and a small and large group discussions, and that you can register online for. And lastly, just like every week, Donna's a very important part of the Buddha's teaching, just to give back to the community and to the teachers to help continue the practice. And so seattleinsight.org on the website, there's always options for that. Great, thank you.
Thank you, Khaled. And thank you all for your participation. And next week we'll have a shorter talk on this same topic with a chance for discussion and interaction around this.